10. Parasites and Prejudice. Parasites held no interest for Mark Schaller at the outset of his career. Since his graduate school days in the 1980s, the University of British Columbia psychologist has wanted to understand the root causes of prejudice. In one study that he conducted in the early 2000s, he showed that simply turning off the lights in a room made people more prejudiced against other races. Subjects' heightened sense of vulnerability in the dark seemed to elicit these negative biases. A relatively obvious idea, he admitted. Then an odd thought occurred to him. People are potentially vulnerable to infection. Wouldn't it be cool and novel if we found out that prejudices are jacked up when people are more vulnerable to disease? Or maybe, he thought, he could just disgust subjects with acute manipulation, about which more in a moment, and see if their attitudes toward outgroups, those perceived to be racially or ethnically different from themselves, shifted in a negative direction. Schaller, who approaches science with a playful spirit, "I love wild ideas," he told me, had no qualms about entering the forbidding realm of the yucky because he's not easily disgusted. When pressed to elaborate, he shared a story about a meal that he'd prepared at his home for Paul Rosin and his wife. In the middle of it, Schaller spotted a fairly sizable beetle that had landed on his own plate, evidently having ridden in on some raspberries that he'd picked from his garden earlier that day. I pointed it out, since this was a classic food and disgust kind of thing that Paul would appreciate, and his wife said, "The question is, are you going to eat it?" "Of course," I said, "yes. How could I not in those circumstances?" He did not regret it. "I was not disgusted at all," he insisted, adding, "I've put a slug in my mouth before. I don't need any provocation to do it." I mentioned Schaller's robust constitution because I suspect it may explain his hubris in attempting the cute manipulation earlier alluded to. His plan was to test whether subjects developed more negative views of outgroups immediately after they ate a durian. For those unfamiliar with this exotic fruit from Southeast Asia, a durian looks like a prickly football and has edible flesh that is famously stinky. Indeed, its stench is often likened to that of rotting onions or sweaty gym socks. Mountains of them. Overpowering is a common adjective used to describe its odor. "I went to a little Vietnamese market to buy one," said Schaller, "and they almost refused to sell it to me. They said, 'Do you realize what you're getting here?'" Not dissuaded, he proceeded with the transaction, but even he was no match for the durian. On the drive home, he admitted, "I had to put it in the trunk." Alas, he weathered the assault on his senses for no apparent scientific gain. The fruit that made Schaller gag turned out to be an unreliable elicitor of disgust. Vancouver, where the study was conducted, has a huge Asian population, and a number of the subjects in the trial were familiar with the durian and loved it. According to him, their reaction was, "Yeah, it's stinky, but it's delicious." He was forced to scrap the trial. But before doing so, he noticed that the data collected from non-Asians suggested that his theory, far-fetched as it sounded, might have merit. Schaller tried another tactic, opting to revolt subjects with a slideshow of snotty noses, faces covered in measles spots, and other disease-related stimuli that previous research had demonstrated evoked near-universal disgust. The control group saw pictures depicting threats unrelated to infection, for example, electrocution or being run over by a car. All the subjects were then asked to fill out a questionnaire that assessed their support for allocating government funds to help immigrants from Taiwan and Poland, groups whom they ranked as very familiar, as Vancouver is also home to many transplants from Eastern Europe, versus immigrants from Mongolia and Peru, whom they rated as unfamiliar. In comparison to the controls, the subjects who saw the germ-evoking photos showed a sharply elevated preference for familiar immigrant groups over lesser-known ones. Drawing on more than a decade of research by himself and others since the study was published, Schaller offered this interpretation of the findings. Over human history, exotic people have brought with them exotic germs, which tend to be especially virulent to local populations, so foreignness seems to trigger prejudice when we feel at greater risk of getting sick. Also, it may be that lurking in the backs of our minds are concerns that the foreigner does not have as high standards of hygiene, or that he doesn't follow culinary practices that reduce the risk of foodborne illness. Prejudice, Schaller points out, is all but shunning others based on superficial impressions, so the sentiment, ugly as it is ideally suited for the purpose of shielding us from disease. Related trials suggested that the mind's sense of foreign is blurry. Schaller, in collaboration with other researchers, discovered that any reminder of our susceptibility to infection makes us more prejudiced against the disabled, the disfigured, the deformed, and even the obese and elderly. In short, a vast swath of the population who pose no health threat to anyone. Infectious disease causes a wide variety of symptoms, so we're probably picking up on the fact that the person is not normal-looking, he said. By normal, he means a caveman's notion of what a healthy person should look like. Until very recently, the prototype human being, as he puts it, was rarely overweight or much older than 40. So people who are obese or show signs of old age, like bags under their eyes, liver spots, and curled yellow nails, are categorized as weird. Like a smoke detector, your germ detection system is designed to sound at the least hint of danger. A false alarm could mean a lost social opportunity. But if someone displays contagious symptoms that you mistakenly think are innocuous, it could cost you your life. Better safe than sorry seems to be nature's motto. The germ detection system is not only crudely calibrated, but also designed to operate largely outside of conscious awareness, being much more swayed by feelings than facts. To underscore that point, Schaller described an experiment that began with his team showing subjects photos of two men. The first had a port wine birthmark on his face, but was characterized as strong and healthy. The second man looked outwardly robust, but accompanying information told the subjects that he had a very contagious, drug-resistant strain of tuberculosis. The participants were then given a computer-based reaction time test to tease out which of the men they subconsciously associated with infection. In spite of the information shared with the subjects, the test revealed that they perceived the man with the harmless birthmark to pose the greater disease threat. According to Schaller, subjects also stare longer at disfigured faces than they do at the same faces photographically altered to correct the abnormality. In cognitive science, as a rule, the more attractive you are, the better your recollection. For example, people peer longer at angry faces and remember them better afterward. But in the case of disfigured faces, the reverse effect was noted. Participants in the trial had much poorer recall of individuals displaying anomalies, often confusing them with one another. Or as Joshua Ackerman, a scientist who was involved in the trial, put it, the participants in the study were looking without really seeing. They all look the same to me is a common refrain heard when people are called upon to tell apart individuals who belong to unfamiliar races, and the same dehumanizing trend seems to apply here. In the case of an angry face, we carefully encode the features so that we'll recognize a potentially hostile person in another situation. But the unique traits of a disfigured person, save for the disfigurement itself, are of no use in tracking a potential source of contagion, with the result that we focus on the salient threat to the exclusion of the individual's other characteristics. To Schaller, it's mind-boggling that scientists have only recently come to appreciate that parasites in our surroundings might inflame prejudice, given that they've known about other behavioral defenses against disease, especially in animals, for decades. Viewed from a different angle, however, the oversight didn't surprise him. A lot of what people study is based on their own personal experience, and most work in the psychological sciences is done in Canada, the US, and Europe, in places like this, he said, casting his eyes about. We were seated in a sparkling new building on the UBC campus with austere modern lines and sleek minimalist decor, about as sterile a setting as one could imagine. We don't really worry much about infectious disease. We forget that in most of the world and throughout most of our history, infectious organisms have posed this extraordinary health threat and have almost certainly played a huge role in human evolution, including the evolution of our brain and nervous system. Schaller coined the term the behavioral immune system to describe thoughts and feelings that automatically spring to mind when we perceive ourselves to be at risk of infection, propelling us to act in ways that will limit our exposure. As his own research was advancing, so too was the work of scientists like Rosin, Haidt, and Valerie Curtis. Consequently, he told me, the label was chosen to encompass not just germ-induced prejudices, but also a broad repertoire of other disgust-based protective responses against infection, as well as behaviors in animals that serve the same function. While he clearly thinks insights from this domain have much to teach us about interpersonal relations, he is careful not to oversell his findings. A subconscious fear of contagion, he underscores, is hardly the sole cause of prejudice. We may negatively stereotype different races or ethnicities out of anger that they may threaten our livelihoods or out of fear that they may want to harm us. We may shun the disfigured and deformed because they are reminders of our own vulnerability to injury and misfortune. Or prejudice may simply be born of ignorance. The denigration of the obese as lazy and slovenly, for example, may stem from someone having little contact with overweight people in a professional setting. Even if we could banish the world of infectious disease, said Schaller, it wouldn't eradicate prejudice. He offered an additional caveat. A lot of the research we've done has focused just on our initial automatic response to people who activate our behavioral immune system. But that doesn't mean that's all that's going on in our heads. For example, my initial response to someone who is weird-looking might be revulsion, but that may be immediately superseded by a more deep, sympathetic response that takes into account the predicament the person is in and can elicit sensitivity and understanding. These additional, more thoughtful responses may not be the first things that cross our psychological radar, but they may ultimately have a much bigger effect on how we respond in real life in that situation. Nonetheless, studies by Schaller and other researchers indicate that people who chronically worry about disease are especially prone to antipathy toward those whose appearances diverge from the normal template, and these people have a harder time moving beyond that reaction. This can have real, long-lasting effects on their attitudes and experiences. Compared to people not plagued by such health concerns, they are less likely to have friends who are disabled. By their own accounts, they are less inclined to travel abroad or engage in other activities that might bring them into contact with foreigners or exotic cuisines. They more frequently display negative feelings toward the elderly on tests of implicit attitudes, and they report harboring greater hostility toward the obese. Indeed, the more they fret about getting sick, the greater their expressed disdain for the obese, possibly explaining why fat people are so frequently branded with pejorative adjectives strongly linked to infection, such as dirty, smelly, and disgusting. These antipathies affect how germophobes interact with everyone, not just strangers. Parents prone to such fears report having more negative attitudes toward their fat children, sentiments that don't carry over to their normal weight offspring. The recently ill display similar biases, possibly, Schaller theorizes, because their immune systems may still be run down, so their minds compensate by ratcheting up behavioral defenses. In support of that contention, he points to a provocative study by evolutionary biologist Daniel Fessler and colleagues, who showed that pregnant women become more xenophobic in the first trimester when their immune systems are suppressed to prevent rejection of the fetus, but not in later stages of gestation when that danger is past. Further research by Fessler in collaboration with Diana Fleischman revealed that the hormone progesterone, which is responsible for reining in the immune system early in a pregnancy, elevates feelings of disgust, which in turn promotes negative attitudes toward foreigners and pickier eating habits. The latter response, likely an adaptation that discourages pregnant women from consuming foods prone to contamination, as we saw in Chapter 8. In other words, it appears that by evoking disgust, a single hormone initiates two behavioral defenses at exactly the time in pregnancy when the danger posed by infection is greatest. Such hormone-induced shifts in feelings are not limited to gestation. During the luteal phase of a woman's menstrual cycle, the days that follow the release of an egg from her ovaries, progesterone rises to allow an egg, should it become fertilized, to implant in the womb without being attacked by immune cells. By measuring salivary levels of the hormone in regularly cycling women, Fessler and Fleischmann discovered that the luteal phase is accompanied by heightened feelings of disgust, xenophobia, and concern about germs. For example, women at that stage in their cycles reported more frequent hand washing and use of paper seat liners for toilets and public restrooms. Understanding the sources of some of these attitudinal changes is potentially important, said Fessler. In teaching my undergraduate students about how to understand the mind from an evolutionary perspective, I try to make the point that we're not slaves to our evolved psychology. When a woman walks into a ballot booth to make a decision about a candidate based on his or her immigration policies, for example, this knowledge gives her the power to step back and say, "Well, wait a minute. Let me make sure my decision reflects my well-thought-out position on this issue, and not impulses I'm experiencing at this moment." The behavioral immune system influences more than our attitudes toward foreigners. It also, several studies suggest, affects our gregariousness, and consequently how frequently we come into contact with potential germ carriers. After seeing pictures that call to mind the threat of infectious illness, both male and female subjects reported being reluctant to approach strangers and rated themselves as more introverted. Changes not seen in control subjects shown photos of architecture. While this shift in sociality is usually transient, people who habitually fret about falling ill commonly describe themselves as being introverted, even in the absence of any immediate infection threat. They also routinely rank themselves as less agreeable and less open to new experiences. Traits that promote a more hostile and distrustful stance toward outsiders and their unfamiliar customs. Still, those who fear contagion, whether chronically or just in high-risk situations, don't shy away from all company. Studies suggest that they're ethnocentric. That is, they predominantly socialize with familiar people, such as family and close associates. One likely reason, researchers believe, may be that this tight circle, the in-group, to use the terminology of social scientists, can be relied on for care and support should the germaphobe fall ill. Intriguingly, several studies indicate that lowering concerns about the risk of infection, for example by vaccinating subjects, can effectively shut down the behavioral immune system, suppressing prejudicial feelings that would otherwise arise when the threat of contagious disease is made salient. In one notable experiment, being allowed to use an antibacterial wipe to disinfect hands when reminded that the flu was going around decreased negative attitudes toward a variety of perceived outgroups, including illegal immigrants, Muslims, the obese, and the disabled. And the reduction was most dramatic in the germophobic. Ackerman, one of the experimenters, aptly refers to this phenomenon as washing away prejudice. Political scientists are now streaming into the field, testing whether central findings hold up across different cultures, and in populations much larger than typically studied by psychologists. One of the biggest and best controlled of these trials, conducted by Michael Bang Peterson and Lena Allray, included nationally representative samples of 2,000 Danes and 1,300 Americans, whose vulnerability to infection was assessed by multiple measures. The Danish subjects took an online test that ranked their sensitivity to disgust, and information was collected from them about the last time they'd been ill and how often they worried about infection. Next, they completed a test designed to reveal xenophobic tendencies. The scientists' findings dovetailed neatly with Schaller's results from laboratory studies, showing, among other things, that opposition to immigration increased in direct proportion to disgust sensitivity. In their analysis of the American sample, the political scientists took their research one step further. They collected data from the CDC on the incidence of infection on a state-by-state basis and cross-correlated those figures with the number of online searches conducted in each state, using keywords related to contagious disease. Google Trends gathers this information, which allows epidemiologists to predict the onset of flu epidemics and other disease outbreaks. After controlling for every variable the researchers could think of, race, age, gender, education, socioeconomic factors, the state's unemployment rate, the size of its immigrant population, Whether it was red or blue, they found greatest opposition to immigration where contagious disease was most prevalent and, predictably, where worry about infection was highest. The last segment of their study proved the most enlightening. The American subjects were given information about a male immigrant from either a familiar country or a more foreign culture. One group was told he was very motivated to learn English and committed to American values of democracy. Another group was told he was not very motivated to learn English and skeptical of American ideals. And the third group received no information about his desire to fit in. Participants who worried about germs strongly favored rolling out the welcome mat for the immigrant of familiar origin over the one from the lesser-known country. And this held true regardless of whether the newcomer was likely to contribute to society or embrace its values. This suggests that the behavioral immune system is relatively robust and insensitive to the kind of information that we know otherwise promotes peaceful coexistence and tolerance, said Aure. Her collaborator Peterson added, "If what I'm fearing is not so much what you will do to me, but what your pathogens will do to me, then your intentions become irrelevant. That says something crucial about why ethnic integration is so difficult to achieve." The scientists' findings fly in the face of current wisdom, which emphasizes that striving to fit in is the key to assimilation. Their results also highlight how poorly our germ-tracking radar is adapted to protecting us from disease in a modern world in which people of diverse ethnicities often live side by side. What's more, the elderly and obese make up a large proportion of contemporary societies, presumably triggering still more misfiring of the behavioral immune system. "It's hyperactive," said Peterson, "and for little protective gain, especially in affluent regions where the risk of infectious disease is far lower than it was in the environment in which our ancestors evolved." That's one potential implication. But he and Aure don't rule out an alternative, more optimistic interpretation. It could be that an individual's sense of what a normal person should look or act like is based on the kind of people he or she interacts with every day, which should help to dial down germ alert levels and associated prejudices. Schaller favors that view. If I grow up in an environment where everybody looks pretty much the same, then someone from China, for example, might trigger my behavioral immune system. But if I grow up in New York City, then a person who comes from China is not going to trigger this response. It's also changeable in other ways, too. The extent that people are aware of real threats to their health, that can reduce these prejudices. Unfortunately, however, most of us are blind to the inner workings of our minds and the degree to which our perceptions are biased by evolutionary design. Anti-immigrant propaganda brilliantly capitalizes on the human propensity to view foreigners as sources of contagion. Its ugly rhetoric is familiar. Outsiders are filthy, repulsive, and lice-infested and will contaminate you with no end of vile germs. Against this backdrop, outbreaks of disease are invariably attributed to their polluting presence, especially in earlier centuries, when the true cause of epidemics was unknown and the death toll from infection far higher. Jews, it was rumored, brought the Black Plague to medieval Europe by poisoning the wells of Christians, a baseless claim for which the accused were immolated in numerous pogroms. In more recent times, thankfully, we're not as quick to torch outsiders suspected of sickening us, but we're still inclined to stigmatize them. The world blamed the devastating 1918 flu pandemic on the Spaniards, who in turn blamed the Italians. For the record, it likely originated in Kansas. In the early years of the AIDS epidemic, Haiti was demonized for unleashing the virus on the world, a view not only false, but also damaging to the nation's already fragile economy. And in 2014, anti-immigration websites and even some U.S. congressional representatives warned that the stream of Latin American refugees flooding the nation's southern border might infect citizens with Ebola, and this despite the fact that not a single case of the disease had occurred south of Texas. No matter where you reside, immigration is virtually guaranteed to be a hot topic come election time for reasons that are by now probably obvious. It's a perennial vote winner. Of course, there are arguably legitimate reasons for opposing immigration, but they gain added weight when people are already predisposed to perceive the outsider as a germ threat, especially when politicians stoke those very fears. Xenophobic propaganda can take another sinister form. Its progenitor is that favorite taunt of the playground bully: "You've got cooties." Grown-up bullies are notorious for fomenting hatred by branding the target of their aggression, usually a vulnerable minority, a parasite, or other vehicle for transforming infection. This tradition has deep roots. The ancient Romans vilified outsiders as detritus and scum. Jews, history's favorite scapegoats, were depicted by the Nazis as leeches on society, setting the stage for the Holocaust. Meanwhile, in the United States, law-abiding Japanese-American civilians were called yellow vermin, a slur that became a rallying cry for imprisoning them in internment camps. In 1994, Rwanda erupted in a genocidal bloodbath when Hutu extremists incited their followers to exterminate the Tutsi cockroaches. White supremacists have an extra advantage in leveraging our fear of contagion for the purpose of fueling hate. Since dirt, feces, and many insects that transmit disease are typically brown or black, many of us associate dark shades with impurity and contamination. Such habits of thought may well have helped to justify banning blacks in the Jim Crow South from sharing lunch counters and drinking fountains with whites, and an even greater anathema to white Southerners: sharing swimming pools. Indeed, some of the most bitterly fought battles over integration took place at pools, and anger over the issue followed blacks on their migration north. In Pittsburgh in the 1930s, African Americans were dragged out of a public pool and ordered to stay away unless they could proffer health certificates showing that they were free of disease. A generation later, Latinos on the West Coast faced similar persecution. In some Los Angeles communities in the 1950s, Hispanic Americans were allowed to swim only on Mondays, Mexican Day, after which the pool was drained and refilled for use by whites alone. Gerald L. Clore and Gary D. Sherman, the psychologists who studied the mind's tendency to link dark colors with impurity, suspect fear of contagion might even lie at the root of anti-miscegenation laws in the South. The one drop of blood rule, which remained in effect until the mid-20th century, held that a mere trace of African heritage could taint the pure white race. The implication of this research borders on the absurd. Each of us, it suggests, might be able to enhance our acceptance and integration into society through special, some might even say obsessive, attention to cleanliness. To put it bluntly, our inner bigot smiles on the immaculately dressed, the well-coiffed, hair ideally tied back from the face, the clean-shaven, the deodorized, the sweet of breath, and the meticulously manicured. To complete this picture of perfect hygiene, accessorize with latex gloves and a surgical mask. Okay, maybe that's going a bit far, but scientists have theorized that wearing medical gear should reduce prejudice. Or perhaps the onus should be on the easily disgusted to challenge their inner bigots. When you catch yourself pulling back from someone who revolts you, ask yourself, does this person threaten my health? If not, consider leaning in instead. And if appropriate, offer a handshake or a hug. Admittedly, that's sometimes easier said than done, especially for the readily repulsed. A friend of such a disposition confessed that he was unable to sit next to someone with psoriasis, forget about shaking hands, even though rationally he knew the skin condition posed no risk to him. Sadly, the sick are the most likely to activate the behavioral immune system. So on top of coping with their illnesses, many are weighed down by the shame of repulsing others. Cancer patients often feel this acutely. After having a double mastectomy in 1975, NBC correspondent Betty Rollin recalled pulling down the shade in her bedroom, not to keep lecherous eyes from ogling her, but rather to keep the mythical peeping Tom from throwing up. The best-selling book she wrote about her experience, First You Cry, nearly didn't get published. When she pitched the proposal to editors, the response of nearly all of them was, "Breast cancer? Yuck, who'd want to read about that?" She wrote the book anyway, bringing the once taboo topic out into the open, and many sufferers out of self-imposed exile. Some may think that we've since conquered our queasiness about breast cancer and other diseases with ugly reputations, but my own experience tells me otherwise. Only a few years ago, one of my dearest friends developed anal cancer, but told colleagues at work she had colon cancer. "Anal cancer sounds so gross," she wrote me, later admitting that her embarrassment had even delayed her from letting those closest to her know her true diagnosis. More recently, an overseas friend on the verge of succumbing to a respiratory disease declined to turn on his camera during our last conversation over Skype. Afterward, I learned that he wanted to shield me from seeing him gaunt and tethered to an oxygen tank via tubes in his nose. In the course of her research on disgust and related health issues, Valerie Curtis hears these kinds of stories all the time. "The sense of shame is particularly acute for people who are incontinent," she reports. "Such people are more likely to be avoided and, in some societies, treated as outcasts. Even those who care for the sick or who have unsavory jobs like cleaning toilets or sewers are frequently stigmatized. Worse, they themselves may develop post-traumatic stress disorder when called upon to perform particularly nasty chores. For example, retrieving the corpses of neglected old people who've been left to rot in their homes." "I think it's terribly important we talk about this," Curtis said, "because it's no good saying, oh, you're being irrational and illogical. Of course nobody thinks you're disgusting because you're sick. But I'm afraid we do. And we're not going to make much progress unless you acknowledge it and deal with the emotional labor involved in having to overcome disgust." Encouragingly, research suggests that it may be possible to dial down this powerful emotion through repeated exposure to repulsive stimuli. For example, people who routinely change wound dressings and soiled bedding report reduced sensitivity to disgust, though unrelated disgust elicitors, say sour milk or slugs, may still make them recoil. Although research on disgust has grown immensely over the last two decades, important questions remain unanswered. Chief among them, does this stomach-churning emotion influence the functioning of our immune cells? In other words, is the psychological immune system communicating with the physical immune system, or do they operate largely independently of each other? Unfortunately, researching these issues is difficult to do. It's costly and requires expertise beyond the scope of many psychologists. By enlisting the assistance of a team of neuroimmunologists, however, Schaller succeeded in conducting one of the few studies to address the question. As in many of his previous trials, subjects were shown a diseasey slideshow, but with one major difference. Immediately before and after the presentation, their blood was drawn and mixed in a test tube with a pathogen surface marker to determine how aggressively their white blood cells countered the challenger. Specifically, the investigators looked to see if arousing subjects' disgust spurred their white blood cells to produce higher amounts of a pathogen-fighting substance called interleukin-6, IL-6. It did, and by a whopping 24%. By comparison, the control group of subjects who saw pictures of people brandishing guns pointed directly at them showed virtually no change in IL-6. Interestingly, said Schaller, although the germ-evoking pictures were much more effective in revving up the immune system, the gun photos were actually judged to be more distressing, demonstrating the specificity of the immune response. No one has yet attempted to duplicate this trial, so more research is clearly needed to draw reliable conclusions. Still, related studies support the experiment's general findings. In an Australian investigation, for example, researchers collected saliva samples from subjects before and after showing them pictures of vomit, a cockroach on a pizza, and similarly icky fare. Compared to participants who saw pictures of neutral content, the grossed-out subjects produced significantly more tumor-necrotizing factor alpha, an immune substance in their saliva involved in fighting infection. A similar British study obtained blood samples from subjects before and after flooding their senses with nausea-inducing images of blood, gore, and dismemberment. a feat accomplished by showing them the gruesome 1974 film The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The participants' leukocytes, white blood cells that fight off infection, climbed steeply in number, a change not seen in the control subjects who spent the duration of the film reading mundane material. If, as this research implies, the disgusted mind truly can shift the immune system into high gear, it makes very good sense, in Schaller's opinion. Our eyeballs are providing useful information to our immune system. If they're telling us there are a lot of sick people or other sources of germs around, that indicates that we ourselves are likely to become exposed or may already have been. So ramping up the immune system gives it a head start in fighting off microbial invaders. He thinks there may be another virtue to this biological setup as well. The information allows the immune system to calibrate the aggressiveness of your response to the scale of the threat. We don't want the immune system working hard unnecessarily because it consumes a lot of resources that might be used by other parts of the body. How, at a neurological level, the psychological immune system might talk to the physical immune system is still a matter of speculation. But scientists have begun to track where disgust is processed in the brain, and evidence suggests this region, through a little rejiggering of its circuitry, has evolved to serve an important new function, one that arguably defines the very essence of our humanity. As will soon become clear, we may have disgust to thank for transforming our species into the most freakish of creatures, a moral animal.